Okay, David, most people address you as general. We've known each other for a long time, and we've had many discussions. I want to go to the Mideast.
Sure.
And I want you to help me there. I'm not a student of it, but I know the oil industry. And so I'm attracted to the Mideast because of that. But question. Do you think we would have ever been there if it hadn't been for the oil? The United States.
Certainly been a big factor. There's also gas. Don't forget that either.
Well, you're not exporting gas.
No, but I mean, let's come back to why is the Middle East a vital national interest to the United States, really the free flow
That's
of energy
it.
Through the Strait of Hormuz. It's because even though we are importing far less gas, thanks to you all and the shale gale and everything else and the energy revolution, right, in the United States, we still have a vital national interest in maintaining that flow because it fuels our trading partners. So that certainly is why it's still important.
So we're there. Cheney gives me a hard time on this. He said, you want to be an isolationist. I said, I don't want to be an isolationist. But I look at what happened to us there. If we had it to do over again, we probably would not have gone in Iraq. Is that a fair statement?
It's not one that I will ever answer, and the reason is because as the commander there, actually as a two-star, three-star, and then the commander of the surge, and then a central command, I don't think anybody wrote more letters of condolence to America's mothers and fathers than I did.
Okay.
And I think that's a question for
I think unfair of me to ask, but
not at all.
I can have my opinion.
You can.
Yeah,
and you can ask anything. I just don't have to answer it.
And you have had a great amount of experience being asked questions, answered
indeed.
Them, or not answered.
Indeed.
Okay.
And everything is on limits today, by the way. Everything, except for why Army can't beat Navy in football. That is too painful. And we can't go there.
Do you know my connection to West Point?
I do not. No.
Well,
I hope you've given them a lot of money. If not, I can help you steer
some
there.
I've been up there two or three times, and I was actually up there one time. Bobby Knight was there.
No, that's a few decades back.
No,
more than more recent one.
Yeah, he was there
because he coached there in the 60s.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he was there for an award.
Oh, how neat.
And it was a coincidence. Yeah. I was there same night.
Yeah.
So they told me it's black tie. So we're black tie all but one. Knight. He shows up in a yellow sweater.
he marches to a different drum.
Oh, totally. But anyway, yeah, I'm a Army supporter, and but let's go back to the Mideast. The Sunnis and the Shias, it's been going on for centuries, and it's from this outsider I look at it, it isn't going to ever end.
I think you're accurate to say that it's a generational struggle. I'd add that it's not just between Sunni Arabs and Shia Arabs. It's between Iranians and Saudis, again, Persians and Arabs. It's between Kurds and Arabs in some cases. It's between, there are other minorities. There are Christians, Yazidi, Shabak. It's a real kaleidoscope, a mixing bowl of, and then add in tribal affiliations, and you have a very, very challenging situation, which is, you know, candidly, I think, why some of these countries over time gravitated to autocrats, because that's a little bit what it took to keep everybody from shooting each other.
Okay, David, why in the hell do we want to go in there?
Well, we don't want to go in there, but we have to.
Okay,
so I'll lay it out for
you.
Five lessons from recent years. Number one, Islamic extremists will exploit ungoverned spaces in that region and actually in some others as well. Number two, and this is why we have to go in there, the effects of this will not be confined to the country in which they're exploiting an ungoverned space or even to the neighboring countries of the region. They'll spill into, as in the case of the tsunami of refugees from Syria, into our allies' areas in Europe and even beyond. And they will foment, they'll spew extremism, violence, instability, and refugees over a region. Three is, we have to lead. There's no alternative. You might get lucky every now and then and have a country like France takes on a smallish problem like yeah, Mali
for a little
but
while.
By and large, even there, we'll provide a lot of support. But we've got to leave. We should have a coalition. That coalition should include Islamic countries. They know about this better than anybody else. There's far more Muslims being killed by Muslim extremists, Islamic extremists, than they are killing others. Four is you got to have a comprehensive approach. It just can't be counterterrorism operations alone. It doesn't mean we have to provide the boots on the ground. We shouldn't, if by any means, if there's any alternative possible at all. And I think we actually are pioneering something that's fairly revolutionary, where we're providing the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets, precision strike, and it's the host nation forces, as in the case of, say, of Iraq, that are providing the ground combat forces. And I think that's the way it should be for two reasons. One is that if they can't do it, then they're not going to be able to hold the gains that we might otherwise achieve. Second is, there's still a reaction to us going in on the ground in some of these countries. We have to be very careful about that. The same as we should be very careful not to promote ideas of neighboring countries in some cases going into these countries either, because that raises all kinds of local hackers.
Okay, question.
But then the last one is that it's a generational struggle. This is not even just a marathon, much less a sprint. It's an ultra marathon, which then comes back to how do you do this? And the answer is you do it as absolutely cost effectively as you possibly can, especially when it comes to lives, but also when it comes to treasure, if you will.
All right.
So no choices.
Okay, tell me, I would like to just pull out of there.
A lot of people
okay.
would. Sure.
All right.
I'd like to as well. The problem
okay.
is it's just not realistic.
You go back
realistic.
To, how old are you?
That's classified, Boone.
You're serious?
Of course not. It's on Wikipedia. What are you talking about?
How old are you?
63.
Okay, so I'm 25 years older than you. All right. So
you heard it here first. Okay.
I could be your father easily. Well, I've got a daughter your age.
Almost. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So I go back and I know why I think we were there. What brought us there was the embargo in 73.
Well, I mean, what brought us there in 2003 for the invasion of Iraq was Saddam Hussein and a strong conviction.
But
that
we moved the Fifth Fleet in there
mass destruction.
In 75.
Well, there's no question that we went in. When we first started getting involved there, it was without question because of the energy resources
okay.
in that region, unquestionably.
Yo, you're agreeing with me then.
Yep.
That CN-70, the United States peaked on oil at 10 million barrels a day.
Yeah, but we could top that, as you know, if the price goes up enough. I mean, we were knocking on the door at 9.6 million barrels per day.
Just a second. I don't want to go there yet. Okay. I'm talking about 70.
I don't want to let facts confuse
I know, but,
us here.
But I'm a geologist, and I got
are.
Out of school at 51,
mm-hmm.
and we peaked in 70, and it was 10 million barrels a day.
Yep.
Then we And that was all conventional production. And then we started to decline. We declined
yep.
down to 4 million barrels a day. But in 73, we got the embargo.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and I agreed with what was done. I said, I'm a peak oil guy. I thought the oil in the world peaked in 1985.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm a King Hubbard.
American ingenuity and technology and flexible capital markets and small and medium enterprises proved us all wrong. Or proved you wrong, at least.
Okay, so they moved the Fifth Fleet in there.
Yep.
Bahrain, and
mm-hmm.
that was where we had to be sure we protected not only
yep.
oil for friends,
yep.
but for ourselves.
Exactly right.
Okay, so
and then keep in mind that a few years later, when the Soviets at that time, still the Soviet Union, invaded Afghanistan, we were in there for another reason, and that was fear that they would actually invade Iran, of all countries, and somehow control the Straits of Hormuz. So this has always come back to our national interest has to do with the free flow of energy resources.
Okay.
And it's still not quite 40% of the world's resources go through the Strait of Hormuz, but it's pretty close to it, I think.
No.
Given day?
No. 17 million barrels a day in the world produces 95 million. So it's 20% of the oil goes through the Straits of Hormuz. And 17 million a day, and we get 1.2 million of it.
Yeah, we don't need anywhere near what we used
to
in the past.
At one time, we got 7 million barrels
sure.
a day. Sure. Okay, so that, we don't all, need that all goes to China, mm-hmm. and it goes to Europe. And we get nothing for it.
I think it must be 40% of the non-domestic oil production, not just ours, but of others. I think that. I
well,
think
ours is nine.
Is
well, it's 9.7.
Yes,
Russia's 9.7. Yeah, Russia's 10.
Yep.
The Saudis
about 10-ish.
Yeah, they claim they claim a lot more. I didn't think they could sustain 10. They did last year.
Yep.
But they to get to 10.8, I think they were drawing out of storage. And so I think they
I'm not
now,
so sure, because I was the guy that actually was deputized by the government to go to a key Saudi official at the time and ask them to pump the excess. Remember, they had 1 million barrel that they'd kept off the market. And when the sanctions were going to go on Iran, our assessment was that would take about 1 million barrels off
so
the
you
market.
Say that they could have done, they were sustainable 10.8?
I don't know about 10.8, but I think very close to
well,
that.
Last
obviously, at certain times, they have to take stuff out for maintenance. In fact, I think they're entering a maintenance period right now.
But do you know how many rigs they have running in the country today?
I don't.
124.
Okay.
So they're continuing to, and there's no question, anybody's a fool if you don't know that when oil starts to be produced, it starts to decline.
Although the rate of decline, obviously, has been slower because of a lot of different technological advances.
That's right. But anybody can use anything they use.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's known.
And their lifting costs are nil, as you know. I mean, you almost put a straw on the ground and the equivalent.
Well, they're operating. Guar is an oil field that is one of one. The field is, it's a water drive reservoir, which makes lifting costs very, very low.
Yep.
And so they have the best.
And the Kuwaitis, I think, are the other ones that have very low
lifting
costs.
They do, too. And so, but here they are, and people have the idea that they are always going to be able to produce as much oil as they are. That's not true.
Yeah.
I mean, you are going to deplete core.
Sure.
Yeah, it's produced, I think, now 50 billion barrels.
Mm-hmm.
And so, here, the Saudis now are we're changing power there. The king is
well, they have, and the new king, King Salman, really has consolidated very much, and has created, however, some challenges by establishing his son, 30-year-old. As the deputy crown prince, with the crown prince being Mohammed bin Salman, Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
Well, they sidetracked the crown prince, didn't they?
Well, that was the previous. That was Prince Mukran.
And the 30-year-old.
Then they elevated Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is the Minister of Interior. We worked very closely together over the years. Very, very impressive.
But he's 30-year-old.
No, he's late 50s.
Okay.
He's the crown prince. But then they brought
the deputy crown prince.
The deputy crown prince is the son of the king.
But isn't he having great influence?
He has enormous influence. And he is the one who unveiled the new economic plan. It's really even more than that. It's a very, very ambitious plan for Saudi Arabia.
Now we're gonna sell some of Aramco.
They may. Yeah, they've talked about selling as much as 5%, which could produce somewhere in the neighborhood $100 to $150 billion just for 5%.
But who in the hell would buy a minority interest in a Saudi company?
Well, there's going to have to be a lot of agreements as part of that. There's going to have to be a great deal more transparency. And in fact, I think one of the objectives actually
is to get transparent.
Is to, shall we say, encourage transparency.
Okay,
and
but
make it more efficient.
You know, this model has been tested.
Go ahead, tell me.
Yeah, Rosneft.
Oh, yeah, and that, again.
Yeah. And Petrobras.
Yeah, sure.
And they have been failures.
Yes, yep.
Whoever bought Rosneft, I mean, they paid $12 for it, today it's $5.
Yep.
And and I think that Aramco would be viewed the same way.
The market will tell us that at some point in time, obviously.
If they,
so
okay.
We'll have to see.
If they can get it all.
Again, it's going to depend on the financials.
That's
you
right.
Know. What's the valuation? What's the assessment?
It's going to be interesting to see,
so.
but minority interest in a company,
sure.
Do you think as a stockholder you will be considered an owner?
Well, again, this is going to be the, you know, what is the deal? Let's see what
All this is coming up.
But they need money. They're running about $100 billion deficit per year. They're drawing down their sovereign wealth fund. It's still probably up in the, if they bring it all together, certainly $600-700 billion.
Yeah, I think it's closer to six.
So it's been coming down. And they're, what they're doing is they're using about $50 billion from that each year, and then another $50 billion they're putting out.
They're using up more than that now.
Well, no, they're actually going to the markets, actually. And so
they're borrowing money.
Yeah, borrowing money from the market
and
as well.
So it's interesting to see,
and borrowing costs
and
are pretty low.
Naimi is gone.
Yes.
Yeah. You saw it at Doha. He didn't have anything to say. You knew.
Well, he has been in the works for quite some time. He's wanted to retire.
Yeah, I knew he
knew him, and he wanted to retire. But
this thing is, I thought the Russians, when they came back into Syria, I thought there was another motive there. They had been booted out of the Mideast by Egypt. When was that, 78?
Well, that dated all the way back to when they had the Arab.
And they were gone. Yeah. Now they've just said, you know, come on back in and help us here. And it was an easy invitation.
Well, they had a port.
They had
the port.
Yes. But that's all.
That's the only port they had left in the Mediterranean.
That's right.
And that's why they wanted to keep that so badly.
But you're agreeing.
Now they have an airbase.
You're agreeing with me that it was an easy way to get back in to look at what's going on, and was there an opportunity here? They didn't want to pass it up.
I don't know if it's to get in to see what's going on. I think they had reasonably good visibility. It's clearly to get in to save that particular port.
Okay, so
and they would have lost it. Putin is also not a big fan of seeing autocrats toppled, I think for fear that someone might get a notion that
he could be
toppled.
But anyway, I sat there and watched that thing, and I thought, that the Russia comes back in there. Well, Russia doesn't like oil at $40 a barrel. That is very costly for them.
It hurts them. What is it? They get 60 or more percent of their revenue from oil and gas exports. So that is hurt. And then you have the double whammy of natural gas prices have been compressing steadily as well. And that's a function of, again, Australian LNG is now in Asia.
LNG everywhere.
So it is everywhere.
Yeah.
Qataris are producing more. There's going to be Eastern Mediterranean LNG.
And so when you go back and say, Boone, you were not near as smart as you thought you were. I wasn't, because I thought.
You might say that. I couldn't possibly comment.
But that peak oil, I believed in. And
so there's a lot of people up until about 7 years ago.
I'm on the ground and I see horizontal drilling, and I said, I don't think you'll recover over 5% of the gas in place.
And they have really proved you wrong, big time.
But
and
I had a lot of people.
Now they're getting even better. As you know, first you were driving only one horizontal shaft, now you're driving three more.
No, you're not.
So, they are. They're driving four horizontal shafts off a single vertical.
I don't. You tell me where that is.
I'll get you for it. I'll get it. Sure.
That you can do it, but they don't do it.
They're doing it in some places.
Okay. General. You,
I know I'm on your patch now, but you know.
You
are,
because I can tell you, if you were drilling four off of a vertical, it would be happening in Permian Basin, Texas.
I'll do my research then.
Okay. They're not. What they're doing is the horizontal's getting longer.
Well, that.
And they're getting.
No question about that.
Yeah, getting
sure.
12,000 feet out. That starts to get tricky as far as mineral ownership.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to put that together because you're crossing different properties.
Yep.
Now we'll get into reservoir engineers saying, my minerals are worth more than your minerals.
Sure.
And so that gets back into. Anybody's been in the business as long as I have been in on water floods.
Yeah.
And those take long years to unitize because nobody can ever come to agreement.
Yeah. Who must be a lawyer's dream, though. Huh?
A lawyer and a reservoir engineer both.
Uh-huh.
And so it is. And so here you have now gone to horizontal. Well, it's unbelievable that when you start to look at what you drain, you don't drain very much on these wells. Sure. I mean, because the reservoir is not in communication.
Correct. Yep.
And it and so it's but the United States now in the Permian Basin has, we have produced about 50 million barrels there, about what GWR has in all of the Permian Basin.
Pretty extraordinary.
And now you probably have more than that to recover.
Mm-hmm.
So the United States could announce energy independence.
Well, we are already more independent. What you're saying is that we could be energy self-sufficient.
Yes.
And that one, I think, is a little bit more of a stretch.
Why?
Because, again, this is sheer economics. Again.
Because it gets too expensive.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah. All right. I mean, there's no question that the assets are there in the ground. The question is, can you drill them economically or not? And a business is not going to do that.
Well, we know. I mean, it was a beautiful operation at $100.
Phenomenal.
$100 a barrel.
Even better, $110.
Well, but you can do. I mean, you can get down to. You go back to work at $60 a barrel.
I think they're going back to work at $45 a barrel. Some of them.
No.
Some of them are. Boone, you know, I do actually study this too.
Okay.
And it's a.
Tell
it's
me
a,
where they're going back
a,
to work at $45
it's
a barrel.
Graduated. Well, what I should say is they're not going out of business at that.
Because no.
A lot of people were saying that they were going to go out
yeah,
of business.
Yeah, but David, there will always be a number of rigs operating.
Yeah, that's,
because
that's the point.
The reason that
sure.
have to
no
operate.
Question the drilling counts down by, you know, what is it now? Down over 60, is it 70% down
over,
now?
Over
70? Yeah.
See, we hit a high of 1,609
yep.
rigs
yep.
in November of 14.
Mm-hmm.
Today,
mm-hmm.
we're running 342.
Yep.
For oil, so you're down 80%.
Yeah.
Okay, but you'll always have some rigs work because of contracts.
Sure. Yep.
That you have to drill or release.
And so there's stuff that's going to come back from that, obviously. And
but,
then the other thing is,
but I think you're down to that point.
Yeah,
I think.
But and that's why I mean that's why our the amount that we're producing has come down. I mean, there's no surprise there, obviously. And it'll come down further, probably.
Well,
until it starts to ease back up.
Well, you'll put rigs to work at 50, and
That's really my point. Yeah, is that
they aren't going to rush back?
No, they're not at all.
Well,
but,
I'll tell you the one.
But they've also gotten more efficient. You'd agree, I'm sure.
No
I mean,
question
it's
about it. But
what's
at the
happened.
Same time,
because people said they were going to go out of business at at 60, then it was 50, then it was.
Well, I'm telling you, the rigs were coming down very, very fast
well,
at 60.
Were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. You and then it fell. 26.19 was bottom. We went back and checked 26.19 a couple of times, and then we're now up to 45. But the here that the rigs aren't going back to work in a rush.
No.
They aren't just sitting there waiting.
No.
But so
there's going to have to at some point. There's going to have to be investment. There's also big
but
consolidation.
Let me tell you.
Going
let me
right
tell
right
you how it works down at the bottom. Okay.
Wait, who's interviewing who here? Boom.
Well, it's a conversation.
Oh, well, I gotcha.
But it's
okay.
A good one.
It is a good one.
Yeah.
It's a good one. It's been educational.
What we proved early on, I don't know anything about the military, and you know more about the oil business than I thought you did.
Well.
But they, all right, but listen.
I actually teach about the energy revolution.
Let me.
It's part of the course that I teach on the North American decades.
Okay, but go. You better check that four.
I will check that. Yeah, sure, I'll do that.
I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm saying that you're not doing it. Okay.
That could be. Okay.
Yeah, I know you could.
Because I was at this, down. At, I think, where's the big conference they have every year? All the drillers, and they have everything laid out.
It'll be in Houston.
Floor. And I went down there and spent the day and learned all about this amazing
technology. Okay, let me finish this point. That, and I've forgotten what it was, that, but, oh, that the other day, I could not believe it. Drilling contractor told me, said, Boone, I can't start up for a one well contract. And I said, why not? He said, well, the government now has told me that I have to pay my workers if I shut down, I have to pay them for 2 months. And he said, I can't pay them 2 months.
Wow.
And he gave me an example. It cost him $14 million.
Wow.
And he said, I've got to have a multiple well contract
to
do that.
Yep.
And he said, I could get my employees to tell me, no, you don't have to pay me to put me back to work. We understand.
Yeah.
But you can't do that because the government won't let you.
Yeah.
So do you know a lot about dealing with the government?
I did spend 38 and a half years in it, but I don't know if that qualifies for the kind of dealing you're talking about. I mean, you're obviously going down the road of the increased regulation and the effect that it's had on businesses. And I'm, you know, obviously a partner at KKR. You know, I've actually been with KKR for 3 years. It's longer than any job I ever had in the military. Now, I was in the military always.
Yeah, but you were moving around,
you're
of
moving,
course.
You're moving constantly. I mean, the longest job you ever have in the military is a command, and that's 2 years typically. So,
we've had a...
But regulation, no question about the challenges of regulation and finding that sweet spot, which on the one hand does what government, I think, has a right and a responsibility to do, yet on the other hand doesn't go so far that it's now impeding economic activity to the point that there's...
It is impeding, and that's disappointing. But we've had a good conference. Let's call it continued.
Absolutely. All right. We have, because we've done this before.
And we'll do it again.
David, I'd love to do it.
David Petraeus, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good. Great to be with you, Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks.